So we're in Mark chapter 12, and in Mark chapter 12 you've got a series of exchanges between Jesus and his enemies. We read verse 12, which tells us that following that parable, the parable of the tenants that we looked at last week, the religious leaders looked for a way to arrest Jesus, because they knew he had spoken the parable against them. But they were afraid of the crowd, and so they left him and went away. Well, they went away, but they came back. And their aim then is to try and trap Jesus in something that he says. The idea was that if they could get him to say something that they could use in evidence against him, then they would have a pretext for having him put to death, which is what they wanted to do. And so the first attempt comes in these verses 13 to 17, when the religiously conservative Pharisees got together with the Herodians, who were the Herodians were those who supported Herod Antipas. I think they're a sort of, you could think of them as a sort of political wing of the Sadducee party. The Sadducees were the great liberals of their day. They didn't believe in angels. They didn't believe in all sorts of things. They didn't believe in the resurrection from the dead. They were very secular people, although they were religious to some extent. And the Herodians are sort of Sadducees with power, I suppose. And they'd worked together before. If you go back to Mark chapter 3, you'll find the two of them working together there. And what they do is they try and put Jesus on the horns of a dilemma. They want to try and put him in a position then where he's going to go one way or the other. Because they frame the question in such a way that if he goes one way, well, he's in trouble on that side. And if he goes the other way, he's in trouble on the other side. You know, the sort of question that people put. And the question was really to do with whether the Jews should be paying taxes to the Romans who were occupying their country at that particular time. You can imagine what a contentious subject it was. So there are two particular things, I think, that come out in these verses. And the first concerns the person of Christ, what he's like. And then, particularly, of course, his great wisdom. You can see that in the way he answers the question. And then with that is the principle, or perhaps we should say the principles, plural, that Jesus lays down regarding the whole matter of how we are to relate to the powers that be, those who've got authority over us. So that's what we want to do then. We want to look at these two particular matters then. First of all, Christ's wisdom, and then the powers that be, and of course, including God himself. And so I want to say to you, first of all, take note of Christ's great wisdom and worship him. That's the first thing, isn't it? Take note of Christ's great wisdom and worship him. And I think there are four things here. First of all, we need to understand the sort of traps that are set by those who oppose Christ and his followers. We need to realize the sort of thing that goes on. So first of all, we shouldn't be surprised then that Christ's enemies combine against him, to oppose him. Verse 13 says they sent some of the Pharisees and Herodians to Jesus to catch him in his words. And as I've suggested then, the Pharisees and the Herodians, they're not obvious bedfellows. They were not in agreement on any number of things. And yet they were in agreement on this one particular thing, that they wanted Jesus out of the way. The Herodians were pro-Roman. They saw the invading power then as guaranteeing a measure of protection against certain things, and although the Pharisees did work within the system, they accepted Roman rule, but they didn't like the fact that there was Roman rule. Their sympathy was really not with Rome, and that would become clear in later history. So despite these differences then, these two groups were one in seeing Jesus as bad news. They both wanted to get rid of him. And you do get that sort of combination. You know, the way, I suppose the most obvious examples, the most obvious example is, we're opposed, aren't we, as Christians, both by atheists who don't believe in God at all, and by Muslims who say that they believe in one God and yet are very much opposed to what we believe. And so for example, if you take an example from politics, a few years ago when the anti-war coalition was formed, people against the war in Iraq. Now obviously there were various people who were against that war for various reasons. And it was interesting, the actual group that came together, do you know who the two chairmen were? Well, the first one was a man called Andrew Murray. There are lots of Andrew Murrays, aren't there? But this one is the leader of the British Communist Party. And the other one then was a man called Mohammed Aslam Ijaz from the London Council of Mosques. So here's an atheist, here's a Muslim. They're willing to work together because they've got an agreed goal, an agreed end. And I don't think that only happens in politics. I think that happens in religion. And it shouldn't surprise us then when we get these combinations. And then secondly, I think we should expect those who oppose us to try and catch Jesus and his followers in their words. Mark points out that what they clearly intended to do then was to catch him in his words. They decided that Christ was their enemy, and they felt that if they were going to see him destroyed, then what they needed to do was to catch him out in something that he said. They could see the power of, well, they saw the power of words, even if they didn't see the power of the word. And there are many people, again, like that today. You know, you've really got to talk to people. And you say, do you believe the Bible? Oh, no, they say. It's full of contradictions, they say. It's got lots of errors. They've probably never read the Bible, in fact. But they've got this idea then that, oh, you can't believe Christianity. That Bible of yours, it's full of errors. It's full of contradictions. And if they can, then they will ride roughshod over all that we hold dear, the words that we hold dear especially. And we must realize then that there are people out there who are eager to catch us out, eager to trip us up. And very often then, when people ask us questions, they're not asking questions because they want to know the answer. They're asking questions because they want to try and trip us up. They want to try and catch us out. And we ought to realize that. It's like children, really, isn't it? You know, children, sometimes they're very crafty, aren't they? They say, I love you, Mummy, they say. And that's a warning sign. Why are you saying I love you, Mummy? Well, there's something else coming, perhaps. Do you want me to be happy, they might say. Do you really love me? And this sort of argument that sometimes children use in order to get what they want, isn't it? Well, these enemies of ours, they're no different to children. They use their traps. They try and trap us in what we say. And we need to be very careful, therefore. And then I think thirdly, we can say, this is all under this first heading now, understand the sort of traps that they set. They sometimes combine them, even though they're quite opposite. They try and catch people out in their words. Beware that they often use flattery. They often use flattery towards Christ or his followers. Flattery, if you don't know the word flattery, it's when you try and build somebody up, isn't it? You sort of puff them up. And most of verse 14 is taken up with their flattery. Even before they get to the question, they come to Jesus and say, oh, teacher, they say, we know that you are a man of integrity. You aren't swayed by men. You pay no attention to those to who they are. But you teach the way of God in accordance with the truth. See, all that, you know, before they get to the question, is it right to pay taxes to Caesar or not? What flattery, then? And it does pay tribute, doesn't it? It's interesting, isn't it? When you say, well, that's what even his enemies had to say about them. I'm not suggesting that there was anything false in what they said here. But the problem was that they clearly didn't believe what they said. You know, if they really thought that he was unswayed by human opinion, then why would they have expected to succeed here? And if they really believed that he was one who taught the way of God in accordance with the truth, well then, why were they not listening to him? And sometimes our enemies will flatter us. They often say nice things about Jesus. There are not many people who want to say nasty things about Jesus, are there? It's very difficult to do so. But there are lots of good things that are said about Jesus. And that can put us off our guard sometimes. And they'll say nice things about Christians sometimes. And we need to be careful then that we don't get thrown off guard because of flattery, isn't it? Somebody said, flattery's okay. They said, as long as you don't inhale. Yeah? As long as you don't take it in. Oliver Cromwell, when they were about to behead King Charles, he said to a friend, apparently, do not trust to the cheery, for those persons would shout as much if you and I were being hanged. I think that's probably true, isn't it? The people would have cheered just as much if they'd beheaded Cromwell as when they beheaded Charles I. And I think we need to realise that. So be on your guard not to be taken in with flattery. And then the other thing under this first heading then is expect them to seek to hoist Christ or his followers then onto the horns of a dilemma. That's what they're trying to do. They're trying to put us in a position where we've got to go one way or the other. And if they've arranged it properly, whichever way we go, it's going to be bad. It's going to be the wrong thing. This is their question then. Is it right to pay taxes to Caesar or not? As we said, the Romans were occupying the Promised Land at this particular time in history, and opinion was divided on how you dealt with that situation. You know, at the one extreme, you've got the Zealots. The Zealots, they would sneak out at night and they'd kill soldiers. They were terrorists. At the other extreme, then, you've got these Herodians, and they said, well, you know, there are a lot of advantages that we get from Rome. Let's just try and work with the Romans. And the Pharisees then were more on the zealot end of things, and there were many shades of opinion on this particular question, and often questions like that can be very difficult with no easy answers. And what was clever about this question then was that if Jesus, you think about it, isn't it? If Jesus says it's right to pay taxes, well, that's not going to be very popular, is it? People don't like to hear that they need to pay their taxes. It's not going to go down very well with the people in general if he says it's right to pay taxes to Caesar. But then if he says it's wrong to pay taxes to Caesar, what are these enemies going to do? Well, they're going to go straight to Caesar, straight to the Roman authorities and say, look, there's a man preaching revolution in the streets. You need to deal with him. That's what they would have done. And so they thought that they had him in an excellent sort of position. And they'll try to do that with us as well. Christ's enemies love to put questions like that, isn't it? They want to hoist us on the horns of a dilemma. They say, if God created the world, well, how come all these scientists believe in evolution then? Are you saying that all these scientists are wrong because they believe in evolution? If the world is as young as you some of you say it is then, how come the scientists keep telling us that they found this that's a million years old and they found that that's a million years old? They want to try and catch us out with questions like that. You believe in hell, they say. Well, you say, well, yeah, I do believe in hell. I'm reluctant to believe it, but I don't think we've got any chance. So Bob Geldof then. Is Bob Geldof going to hell? He's a good man. He's raised money for charity. That's the sort of question that they put to us, isn't it? You say that God's in control of all things. Yes, yes, God's in control of all things. Well, how come he didn't stop the earthquake? How come he didn't stop the tsunami? How come there were those floods in Manila? You say that God is a God of love. We say God is love. And yet they say, well, all this suffering in the world. And they'll give you an example, perhaps from very close to home, where somebody has died or somebody is very ill. And they say, well, how can you believe in a God of love? And those are the sort of questions that we get, isn't it? People trying to put us on the horns of a dilemma. And we must expect that. And we must think about the answers. You say, well, hang on, you haven't given the answers to those questions. I don't think they're easy questions to answer. I think there are answers. And I trust that as you think about them, you'll see the answers. But my purpose is not to answer those questions this morning, but just to remind us that those are the sort of questions we're going to get. Okay, that's all under that first heading then. To understand the sort of trap set by those who oppose Christ and his followers. And then secondly, recognize, this is, you know, it's a bit depressing, isn't it? You think, well, I didn't come to church this morning to be depressed. Well, there's that, but then, at the same time, recognize Christ's ability to give answers, first of all, before that, to see through the traps that are set by his enemies. He sees through them. I think that's the first encouragement. We mustn't miss that, must we? First of all, Christ knows that there's a hypocritical trap afoot. Mark tells us in verse 15, but Jesus knew their hypocrisy. He knew what was going on. Jesus is not stupid, is he? He knew. And he says to them, why are you trying to trap me? Do they think he's so foolish that he doesn't realize? Do unbelievers think we're so stupid that we don't know what they're up to? Well, perhaps they're right sometimes, I don't know. But we shouldn't be in that position, should we? There's a note of exasperation in what Jesus says there, isn't it? Why are you trying to trap me? It's again, isn't it? It's the same thing that's going on. And when we are confronted then by such questions, we should remember that God knows. God knows. And the Lord Jesus Christ knows. And we should seek to be discerning ourselves as well. We're not under any obligation to answer every question that's put, is it? Sometimes you're wasting your time telling people where Cain got his wife. They don't really want to know where Cain got his wife. They just want to try and ridicule the gospel. And I think it's also worth saying, isn't it, that Christ knows the motives that lie behind every question. We don't always know the motives, do we? But he knows, and he sees into our very hearts. And so if any of you, I'm not aware of any of you doing this, but if you're just asking questions to be a skeptic, a cynic, well, Christ knows. You need, if you're going to ask questions, and you're welcome to ask questions, but they must be honest questions, true questions, mustn't they? Real questions. And then thirdly, I've lost myself now, haven't I? No, that's the first thing, isn't it? He knows, that's right, he knows when there's a historical trap afoot. And then he knows how to expose those things. That's the second part of this second point, isn't it? Jesus says, bring me a denarius, he says, and let me look at it. Now, I think they probably were wondering at first exactly what he was going to do, but Jesus knew exactly what he was doing. Now, a denarius is a small silver coin that was in fairly common use in those days. It was a day's wages, and its significance then really was it was the only coin that was acceptable for paying your tax. If you wanted to pay your tax, which you had to the Romans, then it was with denarii that you did it. You did it with these silver coins. And a denarius of that day, Tiberius was the emperor at that particular time. You can buy these coins if you... I don't know what they are, about 50, 60 pounds. You can get hold of them. They were fairly abundant. Probably best to get a model. A replica, that's the word I'm looking for. A replica rather than spending all that money. So what would you have on this coin? You had Tiberius then, the emperor, on the one side. And he was portrayed there as a semi-divine son of the god Augustus and the goddess Livia. That's his parents. And the inscription would have read then, Tiberius Caesar Augustus, son of the divine Augustus, then son of the god Augustus. And then on the other side you had Pontifex Maximus, which actually means chief bridge builder, but it was a title then that the Roman emperors held and that the Pope in Rome still uses today. And Both the representation then and the inscription, they were rooted in this imperial cult then, where the emperors wanted not only honour, but they wanted worship as well from the people. And there was a claim then to divine honour on the coin itself. Now, the coin was in common circulation, and the people there, they'd seen them before. They knew what they looked like. And again, I think we see the wisdom of Christ here, don't we? Instead of attempting a straight answer, you know, or instead of saying, well, on the one hand and then on the other hand, Jesus doesn't do that. He cuts right through the whole thing. And he begins then by seeking a response from them. He wants them to commit themselves. You see what he's doing, isn't it? You know, they want him to commit himself. But he wants them to commit themselves first. And I think when we're talking with people, we've got to do something like that, haven't we? You know, if people say to you, tell me where Cain got his wife, well, I think the thing is to say, well, there's obviously a particular reason why you're asking that question. If I tell you the answer, will you agree, and we can ask them anything, can't we? Will you agree then to sit down and read the Bible properly with me? Will you come to church with me? next Sunday if I can tell you the answer to that question. I think we've got to get some commitment from them. We're under no obligation to tell them where Cain got his wife, are we? Or whatever other particular question. Why does God allow suffering? What about all these scientists who believe in evolution? We're not under any obligation to give them answers. If they're genuine questions, of course, we want to help them. So we can learn from Jesus the Master, I think. But the main thing is to admire his wisdom, isn't it? To see. I don't think we're going to be able to get to this level, clearly. But we should admire that, the wisdom of Jesus Christ. And then, thirdly, Christ asks penetrating questions of his own. And the question goes to the whole heart of the thing, doesn't it? He says to them, he's got the coin, isn't he? Whose portrait is that? Who's the picture? Whose head is here on the coin? And whose inscription? Well, they've got no choice, have they? Caesar, they say. Caesar. What else could they say? And like, maybe at that very point, they suddenly, you know, they realized, ah, he's got us, he's got us. But maybe they didn't. Maybe they didn't realize even at that point. They just thought, well, he's doing something, isn't he? He's turning the tables on us somehow. And it was, you know, Jesus asks such penetrating questions, doesn't he? You know, we've got our questions. But you know that Jesus has got questions for you as well. Do you think of some of the examples just in this very book, isn't it? Back in chapter 8 and verse 29, he says to the disciples, who do you say I am? He asked them, first of all, who do people say I am? And that's an interesting question. But he says, who do you say I am? And that question goes out this morning. Who is he? This man we're talking about, Jesus, who is he? You've got to make a decision on that question. Remember the man who came up to him full of enthusiasm and said, good teacher. Jesus says, why do you call me good? What do you mean good? Do you think of Jesus as good? I trust you do. It's difficult not to, isn't it? Why then? Why is he good? What's good about Jesus? He asked the question just in the previous chapters, in chapter 11, verse 30. John's baptism. Where was it from? Heaven or from men? Tell me. Come on, John the Baptist. What was that all about? Was that just sort of a quirk of history? Or was he a man sent by God who came and called the people to repent? I think you know the answer to that question. And then these very searching words, isn't it? From chapter 8. What good is it for a man to gain the whole world yet forfeit his soul? Or what can a man give in exchange for his soul? That's a searching question, isn't it? You know, the soul, your soul is the most precious thing you have. And so even if all the ambitions you've ever had become fulfilled, and you are that person that you'd love to be, but if you lose your soul, what have you got? What have you gained? There are lots of searching questions then that Jesus asks. So we're saying, first of all, that we need to understand the sort of traps that those who oppose Christ set. And then secondly, we need to recognize Christ's ability to see through those traps. And then thirdly, we need to consider the wisdom that Christ has then to expose the truth. He's able to speak then in a pithy way, in a way that not only resolves the question, but reveals vital underlying principles. So you see, I mean, what happens here? He doesn't just win the argument, does he? He gives us principles then. Vital, important principles that are so memorable and so pithy and so important to get hold of. He takes the whole thing, doesn't he, onto a new plane, does he? Because he not only says, does he give to Caesar what is Caesar's? So that answers the question, doesn't it? But he then adds to that, and to God. What is God's, isn't it? And so he takes the thing into a whole new dimension. He lifts it from a political squabble to something to do with God, something to do with the greatness and the glory of God. And suddenly we move then in a different direction. And it must be a wonderful thing to be able to speak like that. And then the fourth thing, the last thing, is to see how, how amazing God's wisdom, or Christ's wisdom, rather, is to all who witness it. No surprise, is it, when you read at the end of verse 17, and they were amazed. They were, I suppose, gobsmacked would be the modern parlance, wouldn't it? How could he have done that? How could he have done that? It seemed as though his enemies, they talked long into the night, setting up this plot, this plan. And they thought, we've got him. We've got him. He's got to go one way or the other, and then he's in trouble. But no. And they were amazed. He escapes. And not only does he escape, but he lays down this brief and pithy, memorable principle that opens these great vistas then for holy thought. And we should worship Christ then. He's the all-wise God, isn't he? And I think this is one of the most amazing passages in the whole of the Gospels. I know that might seem a strange choice of all the wonderful things there are, but it just strikes me in that way. Maybe it strikes you too. So, that's the matter then of Christ's wisdom, and we need to take note of that and worship him. But then the other thing, of course, is the question of how we relate to the powers that be. We'll be a little bit more brief here, although there are five things I think I want to say, yes. So first of all, as we said, then we should expect difficult questions to arise, and particularly regarding politics and power. It's not just, long, long time ago they had these difficult questions, but all that's behind us now. We also face difficult issues, and difficult questions do arise in these areas. And you know some of the issues facing our politicians at the present time. Obviously there are advantages in small families, aren't there? But if everybody has a small family, and our population continues to shrink, then we're going to be in trouble, aren't we? We are already in trouble. We've got an aging population. And there aren't really enough younger people to look after the older ones. It's the old problem. That's why people used to have big families in days gone by. And what's the answer to that? The whole pensions question. These are very difficult questions to answer. And then there's the whole question of death, of course. How people die. How you deal with death. What you do in those situations. Immigration. That's a big subject, isn't it? Who should we let in? Who should we not let in? How should that all be arranged? There's the whole matter of integrating diverse groups in society. Many people think it's wonderful that we've got such diversity, and I can understand that. But then when you've got such diversity, how does everybody work together? It's got to be one nation, hasn't it? It's no good us all going off and doing our own particular thing. And then what about the problems with drugs, with alcohol that we've got? Isn't it the government have brought in this law? You can drink all day if you want, and some people, it seems, do. We've got a real problem in that area. And then, teenage pregnancy, that's a big problem, particularly for this question. And I don't think there are any easy answers to any of those questions. I think there are answers. And part of the problem is that some of the answers people don't want to accept, do they? Or sometimes they're going in the very opposite way to the way that they should be to try and deal with those questions. But we need to acknowledge, isn't it? There are lots of difficult questions. That's the first thing. Secondly, expect our enemies then to try and exploit our dilemmas. Our enemies then will exploit these questions, and they will call us fascists, and they will call us homophobic, and they will use other names against us. And they will question our pro-life views then, that we want these babies to be born, and we want the old people to live on, and so on. And we will be attacked for those beliefs. And we don't have the ability, do we, to answer all the questions. It's often difficult to know what to do. And so I think we must pray, isn't it? Let's pray that those who do have the gifts in this area, that God will raise them up, that Christians will go into politics, and that they will remain Christians, and that they will remain true to the Word of God, and they will be faithful, and that the lobbyists that we have then, like the Christian Institute and so on, that they might act wisely and be a great help in the situation as well. And obviously we all need to take our duties as citizens seriously, isn't it? We've got a duty, especially in a democracy, isn't it? We must vote, certainly, and we must take opportunity to make our feelings known, isn't it? We must do that. That's part of our duty then as believers. And then thirdly, we need to look to Christ for the answers, isn't it? We need to look to Christ for the answer. Now that might sound a bit trite if you say, well, you've got to look to Christ. You say, well, obviously. But what does that actually mean practically? We're clearly given the encouragement in that direction in this passage. Well, it means that we're going to keep going back to his word, isn't it? Back to the Bible. We've got to make sure that all our thinking about politics, education, all these matters, the prison system, if only, you know, we've got all these people in prison. It's just a frightening mess, isn't it? And at some point, somebody's going to have to go back to the Bible and look at this again, isn't it? And it needs to be dealt with in a better way. But that's a whole other subject, really. We mustn't be despondent. We need to be confident that we're in the Lord's hands. And we need to look to him. His wisdom is enough for us. And then fourthly, we need to remember the principle then. This is the last two things I want to say. We need to remember the principle. And the principle, first of all, that we must give to Caesar all that is Caesar's. So here's an excellent principle. I think it'll go a long way to showing us how we should behave with regard to those who are in authority over us. Let me just think of some obvious examples. First of all, respect, isn't it? We must show respect to those who are in authority over us. If it's the Queen, if it's the Prime Minister, if it's a policeman, if it's a traffic warden, we need to show respect. We must do that. There's an obligation on every Christian as far as that is concerned. Your teachers in school, the same thing. You may totally disagree with what the teacher is saying, but you still must show respect to that teacher. And not be cheeky or disrespectful in any way. Now, obviously, we live in a democracy, and so there is a little leeway, I think, for we criticise our leaders if we disagree with their policies. We make fun of them, I suppose, if we think that they're wrong or we think that they're hypocritical. I think because it's a democracy, you've got a certain amount of leeway, but there must be respect. There must be respect. That's the first thing. And then secondly, taxes. Now, none of us want to pay taxes. We shouldn't pay taxes where we don't need to. We don't need to give the government money that they're not asking us for. But as believers, we will be conscientious in making sure that we pay what we actually owe. We may not agree with how the money is spent. You may say, yeah, well, I'm giving my money and they're going to spend it on, you know, this horrible thing or that horrible thing. Well, that's their responsibility, isn't it? Your responsibility is to pay your taxes. Their responsibility is to use those taxes in a wise and a holy way. The Apostle Paul says, give everyone what you owe him. If you owe taxes, pay taxes. If revenue, then revenue. If respect, then respect. If honor, then honor. And then in a similar way, there must be obedience. That's the third thing, to the powers that be. We mustn't be lawbreakers. There was a newspaper article some months ago, and it revealed that millions of people in Britain break the law every day. The most common offences, of course, are speeding, people then talking or texting on the telephone while they're driving, people drop litter, people download music illegally, or they ride their bicycles on the pavement. Those are the sort of things that chiefly are concerned. Other daily crimes include eating or drinking while you're driving. I didn't actually know that is an offence, apparently. Parking on pavements, not wearing a seatbelt. That was this morning. I was thinking of this morning, and I was in and out of the car this morning, and I don't know. I can't honestly say whether everybody wore their seatbelt at all the times, but that's one of the things we ought to be doing. When they said to us, "You must put up a notice saying that smoking is not allowed in these premises." I don't recall anybody ever smoking until after the notice went up, actually. But we put a notice up because the government asked us to say, don't smoke in these public premises. What we do is we try and fit in with the laws that there are. There are laws on the statute book that shouldn't be there. The law about abortion is unbiblical. It's wrong, isn't it? It should be changed. But nobody's in a position where they have to do anything that is against the word of God. As far as I can see, at the present time. Now, it may come that a law is passed that will put us in a position where we've got no choice, isn't it? We either break the law or we disobey God. Well, in that situation, and there are countries where that is the case today, then we have to break the law. Simple as that. But until we come to that point, then we obey. We do what the government says, even though we might find it annoying, time-consuming, and so on. And then prayer, of course. 1 Timothy chapter 2, Paul says, I urge then, first of all, that requests, prayers, intercession, and thanksgiving be made for everyone, for kings and all those in authority, that we may live peaceful and quiet lives in all godliness and holiness. We ought to pray for such people. I made a particular effort this morning to pray for the Prime Minister and his cabinet and so on. But I do try and do that, and it's not just publicly, of course, but in private. We ought to be praying for our local councillors, for the teachers in the schools in the area, for... I don't know if we're going to pray for the traffic wardens, but perhaps we ought to, I don't know. They're a despised minority, I suppose. But we ought to be praying, certainly, for those who are in authority over us. And then the final thing, and the most important thing, I suppose, is to remember the principle that we must give to God all that he requires. Because you see, Jesus doesn't stop, does he, with give to Caesar what is Caesar's. But he adds this very powerful, and to God what is God's. And that's something that these people certainly were not doing. It isn't enough to give Caesar what is his. We must give to God what he requires. Well, what does he require? Well, he requires everything in the end, doesn't he? First of all, your body. If you're a Christian, then your body is no longer your own. It has been given to God then. You're a slave, in one sense, to God. Paul urges us to offer our bodies then as living sacrifices to God, holy and pleasing to him, which is our spiritual act of worship. In Romans chapter 6, he says we're to not to offer the parts of our body to sin as instruments of wickedness, but rather offer yourselves to God as those who have been brought from death to life. Offer the parts of your body to him as instruments of righteousness. You can pray like this. You can pray that your head, your mind, somebody's got a brain there, it'll be used for God. Pray that your lips will speak for God, that you'll listen to the things that will draw you nearer to God, that your hands then will do those things, that when you walk, you'll go in the places that God leads. We ought to be thinking like that. Our body is God's. Our time is God's. We begin with the Lord's Day, isn't it? We read the commandment about keeping the Sabbath. And one day in seven belongs to God. For the Christian, that's the first day of the week, the day on which Jesus Christ rose from the dead. Now, other time is to be given to worshipping God and to serving him in other ways. That's certainly true. We must be conscientious with our time that we use it in God's service. And then money. Now, there's no simple law about money. In the Old Testament, a tenth was a very significant figure, but that's not repeated in the New Testament. I think it's probably a good guide for most of us, but I think there are some situations when it will be less than a tenth and some situations where it will be more than a tenth. But we need to think about our giving. The command is this, on the first day of the week, that's today, each one of you, every member then of the church, should set aside a sum of money in keeping with his income. Those of you who are rich and earn lots of money, you should be giving lots of money to the church. Those of you who are poor and you're not getting money, very much at all, well, you're not able to give as much as the others, but you're able to give something. And we all must be conscientious about this. And then honour. That's the last thing I want to mention. Are we honouring God in every part of our lives? He should be honoured in every part, shouldn't he? Give to God what is God's. And one of the sins of our age, isn't it, is this increasing secularisation. They're trying to push God out. It's like making a vacuum, isn't it? They're trying to get God out of everything. Get him out of the textbooks. Get him out of the classroom. Get him out of the shop, out of the office, out of the TV studio, out of the laboratory, out of the courtroom, out of parliament, and so on. Pushing God out. Pushing God out. All the time. It's inexorable, it seems. Well, that is evil, isn't it? That's so wrong. And we then should be countering that. We should be bringing God into everything. Whenever we talk about a subject, you know, you shouldn't talk about the beautiful sunshine and the wonderful trees without talking at least somewhere about God. They shouldn't put those documentaries on that they do on the television that talk about evolution and never give any glory at all to God, the God who made it all. We need to pray that God will be honored. Well, there's lots more we could say, isn't there? But let's give to Caesar what is Caesar's. Let's give to God what is God's. Amen.